You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader, brought to you by the Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, we're pleased to have with us Charles Belfour, author of the highly acclaimed novel, The Paris Architect, published by Source Books in October of last year. Mr. Belfour is a graduate of the Pratt Institute and Columbia University. His practice is in historic preservation, working as both an architect and historic preservation consultant. He's written architectural histories, nonfiction books, including being the co-author of the Baltimore Row House and Nierzy and Nielsen, Architects of Baltimore. Also, Monuments to Money, The Architecture of American Banks. And another book, Edmund Lind, Anglo-American Architect of Baltimore and the South. The Paris Architect is his first novel, and with regard to it, the New York Post selected it as a must-read book. USA Today selected it for its New Voices book column. It was selected as an indie best next pick, and Malcolm Gladwell, who we may have in a couple of weeks actually, chose The Paris Architect as his favorite book of 2013. Welcome, Charles. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Hey, so what gave rise to the idea of a novel after all this time and your other profession? What was it that was the seed that was planted that led to this novel?
Well, I think in general, I think all nonfiction authors try to fool themselves into thinking they can write fiction. So I just decided to give it a try, you know, once.
And I've read some of the background behind it with regard to your family and the history associated with Germany and the war. Can you tell us a little bit about that, too?
Oh, yeah. My mother, who wasn't Jewish, she was living in Poland at the time of when the war broke out, and she was put into a labor camp, into a factory that made munitions and other articles for the war effort for Germany, and she spent, I think, about 3 years there until 1945, when the Americans liberated Nordhausen in Germany. That's where they made the V-2 missiles.
Right. Yeah, and as you said too, that was the world's first ballistic missile rocket.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, the book is informed to a great extent by your love of architecture, and the architect in the book, the protagonist, Lucien Bernard. He almost seems like an everyman, doesn't he? He has a combination of whatever you want to call it, good and evil, or he loves architecture so much that he's not quite sure what his moral compass is. You know, isn't that true?
Right. He's willing to make a bargain with the devil in order to design buildings. In this case, it's doing it for the Germans.
Yeah, and
so there's a moral dilemma there.
Actually, Lucien describes it pretty well. He actually talks about it in the sense that we learned when we were kids, like having the devil on one shoulder and an angel on the other, right?
Right. It goes back and forth. And in this case, he decides to work with the Germans.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, I have such ambivalent feelings about France and Paris during the war and being an open city and capitulating so early without a shot being fired. In the book you talk about collaboration and how the French felt about collaborators and especially those women who might be going out with German officers.
Right. To be called a collaborator was the worst thing that anyone could call you, the worst insult. And also, there was also the threat that if, France, and the Allies won the war, and collaborators would, be dealt with rather harshly. And this also included women. Mostly very lower-class women, had relations with the German officers. Very few middle-class or upper-class French women had any kind of, really social or even sexual relationships with the Germans. It was just that forbidden.
But then again, in your book, Adele, who's like the creme de la creme of both society and absolutely beautiful, she becomes one of those.
Right. She was based on a character of Coco Chanel, the French designer, who was reputed to have had intimate relations with Germans during the war.
Yeah, it's interesting how, you know, you talk a lot about like the salons and the idea that the French wanted to keep on with haute couture. And you talk about, is it really true like that actresses like Simone Signoret and some of the famous actors actually frequented, you know, situations where Germans and they would intermix? Or
right. During the war, not all these actors left the country. They stayed in France. And so because they were so popular, they were celebrities, you know, the Germans sort of gravitated toward them, and because they were international film stars. So they did have social interaction between, you know, French movie stars and the Germans. And so after the war, you know, some of them were, you know, criticized, you know, for doing that. You know, there was a stigma attached to it. And it so for a few years after the war ended, that stigma still, you know, was attached to them until, you know, it just went away after a while.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say the Germans had like a love-hate relationship with Paris, but really it was pretty much just a love relationship. I mean, they did conquer it, and it was an open city, but they loved a lot about France, and they loved the architecture, they loved the culture, they loved the clothing, didn't they? It was just...
Right. They had a really, really high regard for French culture. That was one of the big surprises in my research, and they made an effort to get every enlisted man, you know, to go on leave to visit Paris. And that's why the city was always filled with soldiers, you know, snapping photographs and walking around with guidebooks, you know, and exploring the city. So instead of having great disdain for other cultures like the Germans had, it was absolutely the reverse, you know, for the French. I mean, they admired their culture and everything, but they really had great, you know, they really had no regard for them as warriors, as soldiers, because they capitulated so quickly.
And, yeah, they did. And that's, like I said, gives rise to so many people still today looking at France, I don't know, in askance, in a bad way, because, yes, there was the resistance. And you actually, in the book, talk about the protagonist's ambivalence towards the resistance. But, mm-hmm. you know, the question is always, why didn't they do more? Why didn't they fight, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's, well, actually, you know, and that leads... You know, it's funny, too, because there's that one scene in the book where the two soldiers ask Lucien about how to get to the Louvre.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, you wouldn't expect that to be in war, but they're very anxious to go see this wonderful art. So, yeah, it's very well done the way you do that, the way you make it clear that they are fascinated with the culture. But what I was going to say was a kind of a microcosm of the book and maybe the war itself. You know, in the first experience of the book, as the book opens... Lucien is full of fear, isn't he?
Because right. I mean, you still could, at any day, you could die, you know, get shot or disappear. You know, you're still, you know, under the yoke of the Germans, and anything could happen to you. So there was always this feeling of fear throughout the city.
Tell that first incident, how he's walking down the street, because that was a really good way to open the book.
Right. I mean, he's just walking along, and a guy races past him, runs past him. And the guy gets shot in the back of the head, and the German comes up. You know, and he finds out that Lucien finds out that it's a Jew that the guy, the soldier, shot. And you know, they just cart away his body. So death can happen at any second in Paris or in France during the Second World War. That was the fear that you live with. You didn't know whether you were going to make it through the day, you know, alive.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. It was almost like the first scene almost set up, like I said, the feelings towards the war. It's like the soldier comes up to Lucien afterwards, and Lucien says, oh, this is the end of me or whatever. And it's also, it's like the feeling you get in the pit of your stomach, but being there all the time, right? It's like this mm-hmm. visceral feeling that you feel for 4 years, and it never goes away. But then, you know, we talked a little bit about Adele. But Lucien's wife, Celeste, is kind of like a counterpoint to her, isn't she?
Right. I mean, she was a very highly educated woman. And in those days, women didn't have careers. They got married and took care of their husbands and you know, and children. In their case, they had a childless marriage, which kind of led to its failure there. So, you know, and they were just struggling to get by themselves. you know, get, you know, through the war, because Lucien wasn't working as an architect. There was no work. So they just had to struggle and get by, basically, you know, borrowing money from her trust fund.
Yeah, and she doesn't understand how he has the capability of what she's looking at is almost an obscenity, right?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, she doesn't like him collaborating with the enemy, you know, designing these factories. So, and that was the trade-off, is that the industrialists asked him to design these hiding places for Jews, you know, for a hefty, you know, amount of money, plus the opportunity to design factories for the Germans. And Lucien, you know, decides to accept it, even though it puts his life in danger.
Yeah, he's got several things going on. One, he's getting a lot of money. He's got his mistress he can buy pearls for. He can take care of his wife. He's doing something that he really loves. You know, it's fascinating to him, and he puzzles through things. Do you, in your mind, I mean, obviously your love of architecture is the same as Lucien's, right? I mean, it's as deep, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, architects would do anything to get the opportunity to design. So it's sort of like their lifeblood. And in this case, he has to make a decision whether he wants to, you know, design for, you know, the enemies who've conquered his country.
You know, in reading about Albert Speer, who features in the book, I always kind of felt that way about him. And in his books, he kind of writes about that. But he loved his architecture so much, and Lucien and Herzog kind of have a love-hate relationship towards it too. But he loved it so much that I think he kind of lost sight of what he was doing. Do you feel the same way too about that?
Yeah, in the 1930s, this was a worldwide depression, and architects had absolutely no work at all. So, you know, by sheer chance, you know, Speer came into contact with people who knew Hitler. You know, Hitler came to power. Hitler gave him the opportunity to design some things, and Hitler recognized what a talented, intelligent man he was, and so he took him under his wing as his architect, and so he was able to design, you know, some, you know, really huge structures. Not all of them got built, but you know, he sold his soul to the devil.
Yeah, he did. And then he served his 20 years, and then he actually, one of the few Germans who actually got out of Spandau and had another 20 years to live, because he died in the 80s.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and also, you know, I think he actually constructed the German pavilion in Paris at the World's Fair. I guess that was in 1937.
Yeah, he got lots of opportunities to design, you know, for Hitler, you know, and he, you know, I don't think he was necessarily in the very beginning a member of the Nazi Party, but he just saw an opportunity, and he took it.
Yeah, it's kind of like Lucien. But, I mean, if you look at things like the Cathedral of Light, it's just amazing. It's, what's the name of the filmmaker, the woman who also worked for Hitler? I forgot her name.
Leni Riefenstahl, I think.
Yeah.
Riefenstahl.
And she was a genius, too. And he was a genius. But then, Herzog and Lucien, they are more of the Bauhaus movement, and they don't make fun of Albert Speer, but they look at his work as kind of hearkening back to the past, don't they?
Right, because that's what Hitler likes. So you do what the architect does what the client likes. You know, even though it may in opposition to what you really, you know, believe in, but, you know, this is a business, so you cater to the client's wishes, usually.
Yeah, and that's why it's so funny. It doesn't seem like, well, no, it's not a funny book, but there are funny moments in it. And one is this guy, what's the guy's name who was actually Herzog's boss, the one who's a complete cretin and doesn't know anything about architecture?
I think his name was Lieber, I think.
Yeah, Lieber. Like, so they have to listen to him, and he's kind of like their boss, so they kind of have to do what he says, but they kind of sneakily get around that, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right, so they both love, you know, modernist architecture, and modernist architecture at that time was something quite radical. You know, and so they both happen to have a love for it. So they kind of conspire to get these buildings designed in that style. So, yeah, that's just, you know, some of the architecture that, you know, I put into the book.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Herzog is such a, it's hard to say it, but he's such a nice Nazi, and he and Lucien become fast friends, and if it wasn't for the war, obviously they would be great, to use the word again, collaborators in architecture, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I came across some information about a German officer who kept a diary, a secret diary, and, you know, in it he put that, you know, how ashamed he was of how, you know, the Germans rounded up Jews and other people, you know, and carted them off, and he felt very humiliated by it, you know, and he thought it was wrong, but, you know, of course he couldn't say anything, you know, aloud, you know, he would be arrested, but he noted it in his journal. So that became the inspiration for Herzog, that there were German officers who had doubts about, you know, about some of the things that were going on, you know, not fighting the war itself, but just, you know, rounding up Jews or gypsies or, you know, homosexuals or things like that. They felt it was quite humiliating and bad that they did that.
It's funny, too, because Herzog has his demons to deal with, and then the person that really the book revolves around, just tell me if I'm pronouncing this right, it's Mendel Januszki?
Januszki, yeah.
He's torn, too. He's torn between his own value and the cost associated with his own value, isn't he?
Right, because people have died, you know, protecting him, and so he doesn't think it's worth their lives, you know, for them to protect him. So, you know, he's at times he's ready just to turn himself in, and, you know, he would be tortured and made to reveal where all his money is. So he has great doubts that he's caused all this, because he's caused all this death and this torture of people trying to protect him.
Oh, yeah, and that's another thing that Lucien has a problem with is when he's approached by the resistance. He almost seems to hate the resistance because they're looking at it like doing things for the greater good, and he's looking at them as being communists who are sacrificing thousands of lives in order to accomplish relatively small goals.
Right. In the movies and everything, the resistance, you know, is really played up as very heroic.
Correct.
But what happens is that, you know, they would do some small act of sabotage, you know, rerouting trains or, you know, burning something. And so the Germans, without blinking an eye, would take out 100 just people, you know, at random and just kill them, or 50 people, no matter, you know, depending on how bad the act of sabotage was. And so, you know, lots and lots of people died because of, you know, acts of sabotage by the resistance. So I tried to get that into the book, that it wasn't always, you know, this heroic effort. There was a price to pay for it.
Yeah, but at the end also, and, you know, this is interesting too. I mean, it is a novel, it is fiction, but so much of it is drawn from reality. Do you feel like when you've completed this book, like, for example, with regard to the resistance or with regard to the moments of epiphany for Lucien, do you feel like you're letting it go to the reader, where the reader can draw his own conclusion, his or her own conclusions, as to who's the hero, who's the villain, or who's in between?
Yeah, I mean, lots of people would have ambivalent feelings about Herzog. I mean, he's a German officer, and yet, you know, he doesn't like what, you know, the Gestapo is doing. And then there's Lucien, who's, you know, designing a factory that produces, you know, war material that's going to kill people. So, yeah, I mean, some people, you know, like Lucien, and some people are very ambivalent about him. Some people don't like him at all, you know, because
really,
they think that he's, you know, in the end, you know, he's not such a great guy.
Yeah, but in the end, without going into the end, he does have a moment of epiphany. There's a pivotal moment in the book, isn't there?
Yeah, so I tried to have Lucien changed, his character transform over the book, you know, by the end of the book. But there's still some people that are very ambivalent about him, you know, that, you know, he's not such a great guy, you know, and he has lots of faults. So that's been some of the reaction, you know, to the characters.
Well, let's go into, given that, the moment of epiphany, I feel, is like Lucien feels, it's funny how he feels, yeah, something bad happened, but he more looks at it like he made a mistake in what he was doing. So let's go to the hiding places aspect of the book. You obviously, you're creating situations in which Jews need to be hid, and you as an architect actually thought about this very clearly, sketched it, and then actually did architectural drawings. Why don't you talk a little bit about that aspect of the book, which really is the main part of the book?
Yeah, well, the idea for that I just stumbled across about a period in England during the reign of Elizabeth I when Catholicism was outlawed and priests had to say Mass in secret, and they would do that out in manor houses out in the countryside. And so if the Queen's soldiers came to raid the house, the priests could just slip away into a temporary hiding place within the house. And so what happened was the Queen's soldiers would rip apart the house, and they would never find the priests. The priests would be hiding right under their noses there. So that was the main inspiration for all these hiding places. So then I had to, you know, create hiding places within these apartment buildings in Paris. So I just had to think of ways that people could fit into different places, and I would sketch it out, and then I would, you know, architects use computers now, and so you would draw out, you know, the size of a hiding place and see whether someone actually could fit in it, you know, or crawl into it, and that it physically could work. So, you know, I thought about these different hiding places to actually work, and I did that by just producing these little architectural drawings.
Yeah, it sounds like that must... So you were using, like, AutoCAD, right?
Right, AutoCAD, yes, right.
So that seems to me like it must have been the most fun for you. Because, well, why don't you describe this the stairway that you use as a hiding place? Because that's, like, that was really key to the book.
Yeah, Lucien would go through a house and... he'd have to find the place within the house to hide people. And so it had to be big enough for either if there was one person or two people. And so he comes across a master bedroom in a house that you go up a little flight of stairs to a study, and it's at a different level. And the stairs are sort of wedged in between two walls. So he realizes that he can disassemble the stairs and hinge the stairs up. And so someone, if they have to hide, they can lift the stairs up and then go underneath the stairs and then drop the stairs down on, you know, over top of them. And so it looks like the stairs are completely in place. It looks, you know, nothing out of the ordinary. So what happens is that the house is raided and people, the Germans are, you know, crashing through the house and they're running up and down the stairs, and the elderly couple is hiding right underneath them, just a foot or two away. So that was one of the hiding places that that could physically be done, you know, actually could be, you know, constructed, you know, and made to work.
And that kind of leads me into there's another side to the book, a much, much darker side, which talks about the atrocities, the torture that the Nazis did. And what's really telling is that, you know, what you're reading is just the tip of the tip of the tip of the iceberg of what happened. And one of those situations, the torture involves the stairs when they're discovered. And what's the name of the officer who is really the source of all evil in the book?
Schlegel.
Yeah, so Schlegel gets this perverse, he's so happy that he can do this stuff and then leave for lunch while someone's, you know, being semi-electrocuted. So was that the hardest part of the book for you to write? Did it make you, I mean, was it really hard?
Yeah, I mean, like in the episode where, the chapter where he is torturing the guy using electric current, and then he decides that, you know, it's time for lunch. And then before he leaves, he turns the current on and, you know, goes off to lunch, you know, and then leaving the man screaming. That was the most, that was the hardest, scene to write. you know, because that was, you know, absolute, a total act of sheer cruelty, you know, beyond the pale. I mean, they did some terrible things, but, you know, just to continuously electrocute someone like that, you know, and probably would kill him. So, and it was just such a random kind of act of cruelty.
Yeah, that and the scene with the fingers. And it was just, and the thing that really got to me was, okay, first of all, some of these people were so brave in enduring the torture without giving up a name. And then the second thing that struck me was, okay, this is what I'm reading, and this is what's happening, and it's horrible. But there was so much of it, and so much of it that was even worse, that do you think people today have forgotten or have almost forgotten these things? And do you think, and was part of your reasoning for writing the book so that people don't forget?
Yeah, I mean, as the years go by, I mean, there's still a lot of interest in, you know, Holocaust studies and everything like that. But, you know, the actual, you know, torture of people in occupied cities, you know, by the Gestapo is sort of, you know, it's sort of fading from memory. And so, yeah, you remind the reader, you know, what a horrible time it was. And also, like, things like when they find a Jew living in an apartment house, they take people, you know, just round up all the people who live in the building and take them out into the street. And then just totally at random, they just shoot somebody, you know, just to teach the people a lesson not to hide anybody. You know, that's, that happened, you know, sometimes too. You know, to teach people a lesson not to even attempt to hide anybody wanted by the Nazis, because it would mean your death or your family's death. So that scene too was important. I wanted to show that it didn't go into a lot of intricate torture. It was just this roundup and then just this murder of just, you know, some innocent bystander.
Yeah, and another way you did it that doesn't deal with physical pain is the fact that, you know, your mother and father are rounded up, and there you are, two little kids, and you watch them being driven off, knowing, or vice versa, the kids being driven off, knowing that you'll never, ever, ever, ever see them again.
Right. You know, they're old enough to know what's going on, and, you know, that's the last you'll ever see of your parents. And so you're all on your own now. And so, you know, we don't, you know, Americans don't experience anything like that today. You know, I mean, maybe in like some African countries today where they have these, you know, continuous civil wars that, you know, parents are, you know, are murdered in front of their children's, you know, eyes, or they're carted away. That's probably the closest thing today that comes to what happened during the Second World War.
Which also, again, reminds me of the heroism of all these people who hid people, and also why it's confusing to me how some people don't appreciate what Lucien does, because he does a very heroic thing at the end, which brings me back to Betty. How do you pronounce it?
Betty.
Which, and she's just, like, wonderful. She's like an angel. And one of the things you did that, and you just seem like a very serious person, but one of the things you did that was really nice, not nice, it was really fun and interesting, was the repartee between Betty and Adele. You know,
right.
The way they talked to each other, like they hated each other, but they kind of didn't hate each other?
Yeah, because they liked each other, and Adele really depended on Betty to run the fashion house. You know, it was, she was like her right-hand man, indispensable. But they still had this very, odd kind of love-hate relationship with each other.
Yeah, and the dialogue, it's like one of the, almost like one of the screwball comedies, the movies, you know, with Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn or something like that, with that dialogue that's kind of funny but at the same time kind of biting.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really good... you seem too serious to have written that.
Yeah, really? Yeah, I know.
Yeah. But, yeah, that was great. And then especially what happens afterwards, it really brought things together, especially at the end, which I'm not talking about. So
you know, we talked about the devil on one shoulder and then angel on the other. Whenever I'm reading something like what you're writing about someone striving and struggling, and it always reminds me of that quote by Robert Browning, which is, a man's reach should exceed his grasp, or what's heaven for? And I think, don't you kind of think that when you wrestle with these things and you come down on the right side, like Lucien does and like a lot of these people did, don't you think that's really what makes us human in a way?
You know, I wanted him to go back and forth, you know, and to not be a perfect character, you know, but, you know, in the end, do the right thing.
Well, that certainly is what happens. And, hey, don't you think this would be a great movie? Kind of like The Book Thief, but for grown-ups?
I mean, since the book has come out, you know, like film companies are interested in optioning the, you know, the rights to the book. So that's something that's in process now.
Yeah, I figured it would be, and I think it would do very well. And, you know, you can't help it as a reader. You know, you kind of envision what the characters will look like and who could play them and all that. Did you actually have, when you wrote it, could you actually imagine what they looked like? Did you?
Yeah, have an idea of what Adele looks like or what Herzog looks like. Yeah, so when you're writing this, you sort of, you know, place yourself in that kind of imaginary world, and where, like, you're inside a room, and you kind of imagine, you put yourself in this room, and you're walking around, and, you know, you're looking at different things, and you can imagine what the furniture looks like, or the paneling, or what the light is on the ceiling is like. So, yeah, when you're writing, you have to have this kind of ability to kind of propel yourself into this, like, imaginary world to help you write this thing so you can describe things, really.
It's actually kind of like being an architect, and I can't do this, but it's kind of like seeing the big picture. I mean, my family's been a bunch of builders, and it's really hard for me to, like, visualize a roof line.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that's what you're doing. You're visualizing the big picture, and it's a hard thing to do, isn't it? Or does it come easily to you?
When you're trained as an architect, it comes pretty easily to you because automatically you can envision what something will look like. You know, you can look at the inside of a building that looks like a real dump, and you can envision what can be done with it. You know, and you have this image in your mind of that room, and you know what it can turn into. It could have loft spaces to it. It could have a big dome skylight or something like that. So it just, the type of training that you get, it just trains your mind to think like that.
You know, it's funny, and I'll end with this, is we're talking about imagining what people looked like, and it's funny, one of the things I kept doing in the book was thinking about Adele, who's a great beauty, and thinking about Betty, and she's a great beauty, and especially in one specific scene, and trying to figure out who's more beautiful, or mm-hmm. which one has this beauty that's really sexual, and one that has this beauty that's, like Adele may have, and I don't know, this beauty that's much more, I don't know, but I kept going back and forth trying mm-hmm. to think which one was the nicer looking one. It's just, which one is? Betty, right?
Yeah, Betty is like the extraordinary beauty. I mean, Adele is, you know, a very attractive woman, but like Betty is just, she's an ex-fashion model who's just, you know, in like a, you know, like another league, you know, in terms of her beauty. And she still is beautiful, you know, as she's, you know, getting older. So that's how I envisioned her.
Yeah, she's like the kind of woman that when she walks down the street, every single guy turns their head around. They can't help it.
Yeah.
Well, when I talked to your publicist, Nicole, she said that maybe sometime this summer you can come by our bookshop and maybe sign books there. So.
Sure.
Yeah, I would love to have you. And also, we're definitely going to pick your book as for our book club. So all those people will be there. I don't understand why all book clubs are always all women, no men, but they are.
Yeah, I noticed that.
I don't know. Why is that?
Yeah, you're right.
But so you'll have 30 women there who will love to see you, and they'll all have your book. And then hopefully we'll be able to get a lot more. So yeah, I'll keep talking to Nicole when the paperback comes out. We can talk again.
Okay.
All right. This has been a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking all my questions and bearing with me on this.
Okay. It was a pleasure to be on your show. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next week on The Avid Reader, by the way, that was a great interview, and the book is excellent. The Paris Architect. Like I said, you know, I didn't say it on the air, but it's like The Book Thief in one sense. But, you know, people think when they read The Book Thief, this is an adult, but we put it in the young adult section. And the movie, you can see from this little girl's point of view what things are like during the war and the horrible things that happen, but how she rises above it. And here we have a much more adult type of book in which adult types of problems are entertained in the mind and the soul and the hearts of both the protagonist and his friends and his compatriots and his enemies. And then you have the kind of one-dimensional Nazi figure that's only bent on one thing, which is destruction of the Jews and inflicting as much pain gratuitously as they can. It may be unfair to continue having these books with regard to today's Germany, but I think it's very important that we don't forget this. And as you know, the saying, if we don't remember the past, we're doomed to repeat it. And I think it's important that we continue to do that, because without it, well, it still does repeat itself. Look at Syria now. Look at the Ukraine. That's happening as we're speaking. So in any event, enough of that. So here's the deal. Next week on The Avid Reader, we have a lot of authors in mind. We're just trying to narrow the choices down. You know, and I take a lot of pride in the fact that after over 2 years of this show, wow, 2 years, almost, yeah, more than 2 years, we've had authors now seeking us out, and that our podcasts on iTunes are hitting a big readership around the world. One day, there were 7 people in Finland that were listening to my podcast. Why? I don't know. It wasn't a Finnish author. And what's doubly great is that I love doing this. I know I should stop every once in a while during the show for commercials, but I'm so engrossed in the author that I just can't do it. So anyway, stay tuned next week for another edition. We'll have someone great. And as always, thanks so much for taking the time to tune in to listen to us here on The Avid Reader.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.